Hello, and welcome to episode 102 of the Planning Period Podcast. You're Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I am joined by Natalie Mikulski. Natalie is a doctoral student at Central Michigan University. Natalie reached out to me on Twitter after our mutual friend John Spike suggested I would be a good person to talk to for her doctoral research on Magic the Gathering and how we learn. She told me about that much and said she wanted to interview me. And I said, sure, as long as I can record it and I get to interview you too. So here we are. Natalie and I talk about how gamers learn to play games, my personal history with games and learning, the connections we can make from games to the classroom, the problems with the lack of money in education, and why educators should embrace games more. So sit back and enjoy episode 102 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Natalie Mikulski. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your host, as always, Brad Schreffler, and today we're going to do something a little bit different. You know, we're rounding out the 100 episodes and coming out to just past that mark now, and so we're trying a bunch of new stuff on the show, and this one actually came to me. I got a message from someone on Twitter asking about if I would be willing to be in a research study for some doctoral work, and specifically to talk about a card game that I played since I was in, elementary school probably, called Magic the Gathering, which, yes, is super nerdy, and listeners of the podcast are certainly not surprised that I'm a nerd, but that's fine. And so I got a message from Natalie Mikulski. I messed it up, didn't I? Did I mess it? Mikulski. All right. I doubted myself. I checked it ahead of time, and I still sound stupid. Awesome. Natalie, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. As we were saying before we recorded, it's been a very long month, and it is Wednesday, and or at least this week feels like a month. I don't know. I guess technically it's the end of the month as we record this, but I don't. Life is hard. So, Natalie, for my audience, you know, you were introduced to me by John Spike as someone who knew something about games, would be willing to talk to you, and I'm excited to talk about your work, but could you give my audience an idea of who you are and your space in education?
So I am a doctoral student at Central Michigan University. I am currently just finishing up, so I'm just doing my dissertation. In the education world, I was a teacher for 5 years, but I worked at my job for 10 years doing various roles, and now I'm in the higher ed world.
Nice. I like it. You know, it's I am in my master's program now. I'm in a year and a half long master's program, and I'm past the halfway mark, thankfully, and I hate absolutely every second of it almost. So I am amazed at someone that would go through to the doctoral work at this point. It's not that I hate the classes per se. It's really the work. Like, writing papers is just awful. So imagining trying to do a doctoral thesis just sounds awful. I can't. It's like a nightmare. It sounds terrible. But I'm hoping you enjoy it more than that.
Yeah, some days I'm trying to knock this out before October 23rd. So I have less than a month to get it all data collected, finish defense, and be a doctor before October 23rd.
Wow, that's a tight timeline.
Yeah.
I like it. Well, so can you tell me a little bit about your doctoral paper and what it is that you're doing? And then maybe I know you have some questions you got to ask me.
So my paper is, I'm looking at how do gamers, from the perspectives of a novice gamer, how do we learn how to play games? How I came to this is, when I was a teacher and in the education field, we have, you know, high dropout rates and low engagement in the classroom. But when we talk about video games, we think of that as a thriving industry, and games, people love them. So with my fascination of different games and being a teacher, I wanted to see, is there some kind of correlation that we can pull from the informal learning of games and how we can help that in the education field and how to become more engaged. My paper looks at three theories. I have self-determination theory is one. I have Vroom's expectancy theory, and community of practice is my third theory that's basing my paper.
Very cool. I don't know a ton about doctoral work, but I do like how you write a thesis that doesn't like a paper. I don't know how that actually works. But I would assume that at some point you will determine that one of those theories has a higher connection to learning, or is that not how that works?
So right now, yes, one of the theories actually, to my surprise, because the day before I got approved to do this, I was actually thinking about getting rid of it, which I'm glad I didn't, actually is coming up as one of the top runners, and I'm kind of shocked on it. So far, yes, there's one of the theories is absolutely something we could use in the education classroom.
Interesting. Very cool. Well, I know you said there's a connection. You want to make a connection. You want to talk to me specifically, I should say, about the game Magic: The Gathering. You want to fire away with your questions for me, and we'll see how it goes.
Sure. All right. So my first question is, do you belong to like a hobby store or a game store? I don't know what it's called in your location.
I don't belong to a store. No, I buy everything online. I don't go to stores, generally speaking.
What made you get into Magic: The Gathering?
You know, I was actually thinking about this before, trying to think how I got into it. I don't really remember who even introduced me to the game. I'm guessing a friend in the neighborhood I lived in. That would be my guess, is they must have played and introduced it to us. And my brothers and I all sort of became obsessed with it and played it pretty constantly all through middle school.
Do you play other games? And you don't have to give me specific titles. You could just say like genres.
Yeah, I play lots and lots of games, lots of role-playing games in terms of video games, lots of strategy games, tons and tons of board games and card games. I have whole bookshelves full of games, physical games, as well as gaming systems.
Did you, before you played Magic, did you play Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh?
I started playing Magic before those two became big. So I always saw those two as ripoffs of Magic. So no, I eventually played them, and I play them now with my son, actually. But I learned Magic first.
Okay, thank you. Okay. How long have you been playing Magic for? And if you have been playing it for the whole time, or did you take any breaks?
So I probably started playing when I was in fifth grade, which would have made me, I don't know how ages work in elementary school, but let's say that would have made me like 11. And I've taken breaks here and there, but I've played for probably 20 some years, and I've, you know, taken breaks of time, but I mean, I technically have decks at all times ready that I could play.
Okay. If you were to ask somebody for advice of how to play a game, Magic, would you ask somebody that's novice or an experienced gamer?
If I was asking for advice, I would ask probably an experienced gamer.
Why?
Magic is kind of a complex game, so I would assume that someone would have to have some base background knowledge in order to understand the game.
If you were going to play in a tournament, would you ask a novice player or experienced player, and why?
An experienced player, because tournaments have their own very particular sets of rules, so you'd want to talk to somebody who has experience in that play style.
Do you belong to any Magic communities? And they don't have to be formal. It could be friends, family.
Not anymore. I have in the past, but I wouldn't say I do anymore.
Okay. Tell me about your deck. How many decks do you have?
Right now, I think I probably have four, maybe three. I have like my primary go-to deck, and then I have other decks for friends when they want to play, and they can play with those. But I probably have three or four decks right now.
Are they custom decks or are they standard decks?
Oh, custom decks, definitely.
What's your favorite deck to play?
My favorite deck, I typically play a white blue combo, with a little bit of counterspell and a little bit of control. Sometimes I'll do a white blue and black triple combo, just hard paint three colors in a deck usually, but that's typically white blue are my go-tos.
Have you ever played in any tournaments?
Some local tournaments, some small ones, not like a any kind of national or official tournaments, but at hobby shops when I was a kid, I played a couple times.
Do you have a specific deck just for that tournament? For a tournament, sorry.
No, I think the time I played was a pack tournament where you built a deck at the event.
Did you use any websites, forums, blogs, videos, apps, wikis to help you learn how to play?
Most of those things weren't a thing when I learned how to play Magic. So no, we used to actually use a magazine back in the day. We used to have the Wizards of the Coast magazine that we would get. But no, I did not use those when I learned how to play.
Do you use any kind of technology now to help you during gameplay?
When I play card games in general, I do use, or yes, okay, yes, I do. I use life point counters. So I'll use an app on my phone to calculate life points and things like that. I've also played the digital versions of the game, so I don't know if that counts necessarily to the question, but I've played the digital versions of the game.
And are any of those digital versions ones that you played on, like, the computer, or some people talk about consoles they played them on?
So I've played, there was one on like the Xbox a few years ago. I played a couple times, and then I've played the mobile one. That's the main one I played when it came out a handful of years ago. I played a lot of that. And then the new one is the Magic the Gathering Arena. And I have played that briefly on my PC. I played like two rounds of that, but that was about it.
Okay. And my last question is, do you know the difference between a Timmy, Johnny, and a Spike?
No, I don't think I do.
Okay, perfect. That's all.
That's it. Man, it's awesome. You're making me work through some thoughts there with Magic. I love that game. It's such a good game to like learn. And I like the question about connecting it back to like Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh, because it always felt to me like Magic came first, and then all these other card games sort of said, oh, you mean we can make games and get kids to keep spending all this money on pieces of cardboard? Neat. But they never had the strategy or the skill that Magic had. They were very one-dimensional, which I've noticed a lot playing Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh with my son now that he's starting to get into those. I've noticed just how simple and really boring those games are. So, but he's just not quite old enough to understand Magic, so... I'll get him there, though. I'll get him to learn, because I do love that game.
Huh. Absolutely.
Cool. Yeah, it's interesting. So can you tell me at all what you're finding in terms of connections to learning from sort of the questions you're asking and the research you're doing?
So my main theory, the one I love the most, that actually got me into this whole gaming world and gamification, is self-determination theory. And for people that don't know, it's made up of three elements, has autonomy, belonging, and competency. So when we play games, when I talk to you about your deck, about how it's built, a lot of people surprisingly like to customize their decks. And the second one that I talked to you about, do you belong to like communities, tournaments, friends, family? That's the belonging aspect of it. So how do we keep going? I've been going to a game store the past, I don't know, maybe 6 months, I'll say. And the gamers just keep coming back, and they don't necessarily always have a purpose, but they're always there. They're on time. They're ready to go, ready to play. And it's just fascinating that they want to be there, and they're not getting paid. They're not getting graded. They're just there because this is what they purely love. So right now, self-determination theory is one of the bigger theories sticking out. And when we think of the classroom, back when I went to school, school's mm-hmm. so structured, you know, autonomy is very limited. Belonging is something now that schools are promoting really heavily. And looking at, you know, how these gamers in the game store, hobby store, whatever you want to call it, how they form these little communities, and it brings them back, and how they feel like a family, and how they have trust and opportunities. So those are all things that are coming together that I could see in a classroom.
So when you think about like customizing a deck or tournament play, I mean, are you drawing a direct parallel to like the deck being the content that we're learning, or is the game the content we're learning? What are we taking away that we could put back into the classroom?
So the content could be, I always think in my classroom when I taught, I had this ginormous library, and I told my students, I don't label it at all. all my pictures in my library, they're just scattered. And I told them, pick whatever you want to read, you choose that book. And my students were always just jaws on the floor because they're looking for Lexile levels or DRA levels. They never had a choice to just pick a book. So when I talk about the deck and the game, I always think of school as a game, but the content is like the cards and things like that are more the elements in school that we use to support the content of whatever curriculum subject you're doing. So having those choices to build your deck, those are like your books and your tools. They're supporting you to become the better gamer. And you need your decks or your cards to help you become a better gamer because you can't play Magic without a card.
Interesting. Yeah, I kind of like that. I'll be interested to read your paper as it comes out. You know, maybe I'll be able to use it in my own master's work as I close up. I can actually get something valuable out of it. That'd be nice. Your master's, my master's, not your work. I'm hoping to get something valuable out of my master's. That would be great. cool. Well, that's awesome, man.
Thank
that's
you. Neat.
I like the way you're thinking. I like the connections and going on. You haven't been intrigued to learn how to play after going through all this?
So my boyfriend is, he's a gamer. He's a Magic man, whatever you want to call him. And he tried to teach me how to play, but he's never been a teacher. So he kind of one day just threw me in a tournament with his friends. And ever since then, I said, no, I don't want to play anymore. You made it too complicated and you embarrassed me. You totally did everything wrong in education. but I'm a spike. I like to win. I'm very competitive. So when I hear and I talk to other gamers and they talk about cards, I automatically see my spike senses turning on and I just want to know what's the best card and how to beat you. So.
Yeah. Huh. You know, it's funny that you said that. You just made me think about this. When I was a kid, my brother and I were always determined to teach other people how to play the game. And we got really good at it. We got really good at teaching adults at the time, and we were middle school kids and elementary school kids, but we got really good at figuring out the strategies and the ways to teach a kid, another person, but especially an adult, how to play the game. You know, we'd play open-handed. We would, you know, we'd practice where they could actually see the cards, explain what was going on. And now that I think about it, we were really like teaching the correct ways. I never really considered that, but we were doing it right. We were taking away the elements of the competition just to get the learning in place. And then we would slowly build in the competition as alongside of the competence. And I think that actually worked. We got a lot of people to learn how to play this game now that I think about it. And that's actually pretty cool. And then I never really considered that. That was probably one of my first times teaching people how to do something was teaching people how to play Magic.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. It's cool.
Because it's something you're comfortable with.
Yeah, and throwing someone at a tournament first is really a terrible way to do that. That's just not smart.
No, he knows that now.
Setting himself up for failure on that one.
Yeah, he agrees.
Well, that's awesome. That's cool. Well, thank you for that. That's neat. I like that. That was fun. It was a nice little trip down memory lane for me. Well, Natalie, let's get into some of my questions for you. Let's get into some of the questions I have. And the first question I always ask guests on my show is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Probably money. Because I know it's such a generic answer, but when I taught, I funded a lot of stuff myself. And when I taught, I gamified my classroom. So everything of mine that I gamified came from my own brain and my own funding, my own ideas. And not being able to have those funds is really hard to, especially if you're trying to turn the curriculum in school into a different road, you definitely have to have the funding to do it. And I think a lot of like primary grades or elementary grades can't get into some of these better things like gamification because it costs money to do them. So definitely the funding is one of the bigger ways it gets in the way of trying to adapt a culture or curriculum that's more geared to our students.
What do we do about it? Right? Like, I mean, it is the thing it is. And we've talked about this on the show before, but it's, you know, some of the funding issues come from the fact of just the funding model we use, and property taxes funding a lot of the education system and things of that nature. And, you know, the last couple of months, there's been a big push on Twitter for the Clear the Lists, where teachers are spending all their own money on supplies and instead reaching out and trying to find people to help them close out their own classroom need lists, which I have my own personal issues with. And there's, you know, there's things like GoFundMe and you know, donors choose and things like that. And what do we do? What's the fix? What do we do? What should we be doing at least to maybe address some of that?
So I think teachers are really crafty and clever. I really respect and like teachers that put out there using their cell phones or pictures or, you know, different apps and things of what they're doing. I think just providing people that opportunity of, look, this is what we do in the classroom, and we would love to take it beyond just the basic traditional school back when I went to school. So I think making people more aware of what we're doing and how these advancements, not only in technology, but it could be something as simple as a curriculum, innovating it. That is something that we could even use funding from. I think also kind of going back to when I was a teacher too, just asking people for support. You don't always necessarily need money for things, but asking people, how do you do this? What do you do? Using social media and Twitter to support yourself. And I my last time that I was in the classroom, I was a technology teacher. So I taught over 900 students a week. And yeah, and I taught junior kindergarten, which are your basic four-year-olds, all the way up to fifth grade. So in order to make things last, I was definitely not against going up to the kitchen and asking them, can I have your boxes? Can I have bottle caps? And looking around in my local community to support me with recyclable materials and just try to repurpose and reuse things the most you can.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's so hard because there are so many things we would love to do, you know, and there's an economy of scale problem where, you know, if you're an elementary school teacher, yes, you only have 25, 30 kids in a class, whatever it may be, depending on class size, but you also are teaching them six different subjects. And so it's, yeah, I only have that many, but it's also, I need something for every subject. And, you know, and as a parent, you know, we hear parent complaints all the time about the supply lists and how much they need to be getting for their students. And that's a problem too, but it's so hard to try to, I don't know, work around it. And, you know, it's, I agree with you. Teachers are super crafty and we find ways to make it work. I just worry sometimes that the ways of making it work and the fact that teachers will find a way to make it work just mean that others are not as worried about finding a solution. You know, it's like, at some point you have to let things fall through so that people realize we're serious. This is a problem. Mm-hmm. But it's, teachers don't want to do that, right? Like, we don't want to fail our kids. We don't want to fail our students and not give them what we think they deserve.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing is when I taught technology, if I couldn't give my students the best and greatest apps, and luckily there are some that you can do free versions of, but just knowing like, our trial's out and just looking at their little faces, you know, that made me want to write grants and maybe get a third or fourth job because it's hard just telling them no.
Yeah. God, it's terrible. It's just this choice that we always feel like we're making. Like, I would love to do this project or this project, but I don't have this supply. And so then it's, how do I remodify it? How do I redo it? And, you know, and then we see the studies coming out about how much money teachers are putting of their own paychecks back into their classrooms in order to support their students. And, you know, it's just, you know, we've probably all seen the comparisons of, you know, at any other job, they don't ask you to go get your own staples so you can do the reports you need to do. You know, that's not a thing. And yet there are plenty of places in education where you literally are buying your own paper just to make copies, let alone to do an innovative or exciting idea in your classroom.
Absolutely.
It's tough. You know, you also mentioned social media and sharing out and things like that of the things we're doing in class. And I see that. I always struggle with sharing out and showing pictures of the awesome work you're doing. And I always compare it to sort of the difference between Instagram and Twitter, which is probably not fair. It's mostly just that I don't like Instagram. I always worry that that actually puts further pressure on other teachers. Like, look at this awesome room I made, or look at this awesome bulletin board I put together, these cool activities my kids made. And then it's, how often are teachers actually putting the price tag with that? Like, this cost me an extra $600 out of my paycheck for my kids to be able to do this. And I feel like sometimes we feel like we need to keep up with the Joneses of our peers, right?
Yeah. So I'm not gonna lie, I look at people's Twitters all the time, and I saw that one person that made that sweet, awesome Harry Potter costume going around on Twitter. And that's amazing. They did a great job. I guess for myself as a teacher, I always thought, you know, I rather give my students content than a pretty classroom. A pretty classroom is great. They need that working, welcoming, warm, fuzzy environment. But I'm not artistic or crafty at all. I draw the best stick figures in the world. So I guess, you know, for me, I never felt that I had to keep up to them, because I realized that that wasn't my strength, and I could provide my students a warm, welcoming environment with the best I could of my stick figure people and give them in the end the things that don't cost money, like me loving them and taking care of them and making sure that they're doing the best that they could do, and being there when it rains to make sure I can stand with them by the door until their parent comes. That way they don't stand out in the rain. So I think that's what my students care about. And at the end of the day, that's what I care about more than a really nice classroom.
Yeah. And that classroom you're referring to, that was Stacey Lamb who did that one. And it's been kind of all over Twitter recently because it's amazing. I mean, the work she's put in there is phenomenal, but again, How many hours of work, how much money, even if she's being crafty and coming up with her own ideas, like, just, you know, it's that balance. And I did wonder, even with that, like, what's the connection back to learning? Like, where's the, you know, yes, that makes it a highly engaging classroom, but where's the connection back to learning, right? Like, where's the content? So I like that you said that that really needs to always remain in the forefront. I agree. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. That's question one. We got through one. We're good. Let's roll into question number two. My second question for all my guests is, what is something you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
I wish all educators would embrace video games more or any type of game. When I came out to my school district and told them, I'm getting my doctorate in gaming, many of them looked at me and thought, what a useless degree. Why are you studying that? Like, my kid sits on the video games for 12 hours. That's boring. So I go around and I speak at different conferences around, and I really promote that, no, video games and gaming's, you know, it's not all bad. It's actually really good. There's tons of great benefits. So I wish teachers had the opportunity to try gamifying their classroom. And that doesn't mean that you need to build avatars and point system and buy them candy. I actually talk about, don't buy them presents and rewards. You have to give them those internal rewards more than external rewards. So trying something different, reaching outside the box, looking into new theories, like gaming is one that I found in my master program. And I'm sure you probably are learning about different theories and things in your master program too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I agree with you that I don't think we do gaming nearly often enough in the classroom. You know, it's something that has so much potential and so much power. And I've seen, even in small doses, the results and benefits it can have with my students. And it's huge. You know, it is really, really powerful. And it's so diverse, and there's a lot of levels to it. And I don't think that's what a lot of people realize is, you're right. You said there, oh, it's just my kids sit there, do that 6 hours a day. I don't need them. I can't even get them to come down to dinner. And, you know, it's so many of those complaints to me feel like, not remembering what your own childhood was like. It's like, yeah, well, you might not have played video games, but were you not listening to records that your parents didn't think were great? And did you not, you know, start to figure out that computers could be getting on the internet and spending time on AOL Instant Messenger? Because we all remember what our Instant Messenger handle was, and you better believe we spent tons of hours on that. So I think, you know, it's the newest thing to be mad. Jazz music was going to ruin the world. Rock music was going to ruin the world. Dungeons and Dragons was bound to ruin the world at one point because it was terrible. And, you know, now it's video games. Now it's specifically Fortnite because apparently that's the worst game ever created.
Yeah.
And it's like every time it's just, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like video games especially have just become this like go-to punching bag for a lot of things, especially in the media. And it makes it hard for people to see that the positives that it can have. You know, you talk about determination theory, and one of the things that we talk about in talking about games and education is just how willing a kid is to fail and try again and fail and try again and fail and try again. And those are exactly the behaviors we want in school. And yet we're not trying to pull the things that are making them do that in a game into the classroom. We're saying the games are bad, but keep doing that thing here.
That's freedom to fail. That was another theory I did in my master's program. My classroom was all designed for freedom to fail. My students would turn in their work 19 different times if they needed to, because I was not going to say, okay, here's your zero, see you later. That's not learning to me. I wanted my students to bring it back. If they failed, come talk to me. Let's have a conference. Let's figure out what do you need to be successful, not for me to write zero, bye-bye. That wasn't why I wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah. How did you build that culture in your classroom?
I made posters that I just heard of different quotes. Magic School Bus, Mrs. Frizzle, make mistakes, get messy, take chances. I had a poster that said that, and I displayed different ones like that around my classroom. And I would tell my students every time I failed, I probably fail 19 times a day, and I tell them, I highly doubt you'll outfail me today, because I fail all the time, and I wanted them to know it was okay. One year I used to have my students clap every time somebody made a mistake. And I still remember one time I was on the whiteboard and I was writing something. I spelt it wrong, and one of my students got up and he said, "Miss Mikulski failed. Yay." Just creating that culture is, you know, letting them know that it was okay. And I told my student after he said that, I'm like, gosh, I feel really good that you said that to me.
I think you're doing it right when they're saying that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. God, I'm so with you. I want to put more gaming into classrooms and just in schools in general. It's such a powerful thing to be able to draw kids in and really get them to learn when it's done correctly. And I think we have far too few examples of it being done really, really well. I'm with you. I support it. I think we could all do more of that. It's a great answer.
I tell everybody that wants to do gaming, start small. So tomorrow when you go into your classroom, tell them when you're going to read a chapter. Don't say we're going to chapter two. Say we're leveling up to chapter two. Because even changing your vocabulary changes the way that it's done. I used to call my homework assignments or class assignments, I used to call missions. And when my students would turn them in, I'd write on the whiteboard 500 points, which these points got them nothing. And because they all turned it in.
Whose line is it, waypoints?
Exactly. And they were so excited to just get that whiteboard message that they completed their mission. So just change the vocabulary, go small, and just watch how they feel intrigued they become. They'll challenge you, don't get me wrong. There's going to be that kid that's going to say, "You mean chapter two, not level two?" And that's when you can say, "Yeah, but we're going on to level two," because it makes it more interesting and fun.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. That's good. Good stuff. All right, let's go on to number three. We got one left.
All right.
My third question for all my guests is, who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
My greatest teacher was, she was a college professor of mine. I only had her one semester, Her name was Professor Simons. And she was my favorite teacher because she taught me about responsive classroom. And from responsive classroom, it grew this gamification thought and theory for me. And it was something I can combine to. And it really helped me my first couple years as a teacher. It gave me the confidence to go in a classroom and made me think I have great classroom management because I'm bringing in elements of belonging and I'm not here to be so, I guess, like it has to be this way. So it was her because just the way she taught and the way she was a teacher. And then at night she was an adjunct and it just inspired me to keep going and being like that.
Yeah. You know, the power of modeling the correct behaviors and just being there, right? Like that's just so critical. You know, and it's kind of going back and tying things together, you know, it's when we think about what makes a great educator, it's not the stuff they bought and put into their classroom, right? It's the time, it's the intention, it's the relationships. Those are the things that we always remember. It's not the, you know, don't get me wrong, those kids in Stacey Lamb's classroom are going to remember that Hogwarts classroom. I 100% they will remember that, right? But it's not that they're going to remember every detail of that room. It's going to be the feeling that they have, because Stacey did that because she obviously loves her kids and wants to do the best she can for them. So that is an attitude that I'm sure is replicated in her behaviors, right? And so I think that that's the critical thing. You know, yes, money is a problem in education and we are underfunded for sure. And teachers can put a ton of their own money into their classrooms, but it's the feeling, it's the attitude, it's the beliefs that are what the students remember at the end of the day. I like it. Tie it all together, wrap it in a nice little bow. Like it. Natalie, I really appreciate your time joining me on the podcast today. I had a good time talking, got me thinking about my own past a little bit. I enjoy that. So for my audience, if they'd like to reach out to you or they'd like to maybe get a look at your thesis once it's published, how can they reach out to you?
My Twitter handle is @NatMac 1118.
All right. And of course, that will be a link to that will be in the show notes. And I look forward to reading your paper and getting to continue the conversation about games and education. I enjoyed that.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Natalie, thank you for a really interesting chat and for walking me through memory lane with some magic talk. To connect with Natalie, you can find her on Twitter @NatMac1118. And if you have questions or comments about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram @BradShreffler. I love to hear from you guys there, and that is also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or visit the feedback page on my website that gives you additional options for feedback, which you can find at bradshreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, think about how you learn from games. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.